GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software professionals specializing in the areas of software-defined networking, evolved packet core, and more. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
It is Saturday, June 14th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the minis and the twits.
Oh, welcome, welcome. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Primsch, Bonnie Jean Primsch, that is, in the host chair today. And with me in the air room is Ben Jaffe, who is a web development instructor, a musician, and a world traveler.
Hello.
Hello, Ben. How are
it's
you doing?
It's only me on this side of the table.
I know.
It's really lonely.
It's just you and me putting on a show.
Yeah, there's an empty chair next to me and another empty chair next to me.
Yeah. What does that mean, that you'll be doing the voices of the other geeks during the show today? No?
I could try to do Miles's laugh and... I don't know. What is...
I'm not sure I could capture it. Let's not spend too much time on it.
Yeah, let's not.
There are some interesting things going on, though. There's plenty to do on the show
today. Oh, yes. There is plenty to talk about.
I think we heard from three different sources about Tesla releasing their patents.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's talking about this because it's really, really cool.
Yeah.
So if you've listened to the show for any amount of time, you know how the geeks feel about patents. They basically stifle innovation. Well, Tesla, Elon Musk, Tesla, released a press statement. This was 2 days ago, June 12th. And I just want to read... just a chunk of it, okay?
Can we just start with the name of the blog post?
The name of the blog post is All Your Patent Are Belong to You.
So good.
Which, if...
That's a bit of inside geekery fun.
Very old school. Well, not very old school, but anyway. So here's the quote. Yesterday, there was a wall of Tesla patents in the lobby of our Palo Alto headquarters. That is no longer the case. They've been removed in the spirit of the open source movement for the advancement of electric vehicle technology. So basically they said, yeah, use whatever we've patented. Just go do that.
Yeah.
Don't worry about being sued by us.
Because we're not going to sue you, because we see it as an advantage to have more people innovating, because right now we are not a competitor with each other. We're a competitor against petroleum.
Exactly. Yeah. What they were saying in the rest of this press statement is, well, first of all, Tesla will not initiate patent lawsuits against anyone who in good faith wants to use our technology. So they're quite serious about this. But they also kind of illuminate how at first, when you're starting up a company, you don't want people to compete on your same turf. And so you patent the innovations that you come up with. Mm-hmm. But they say their true competition is not the, quote, small trickle of non-Tesla electric cars being produced, because a lot of automotive manufacturers don't produce any electric cars,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It is...
they do so under duress like Fiat.
Quote, the enormous flood of gasoline cars pouring out of the world's factories every day. So, the idea is, if we want to solve this problem, get off petroleum... Tesla having patents on these things will not help.
We can't do it alone.
Yeah, I mean, Tesla can't possibly produce all of the world's electric cars, at least not currently.
Even with the grand ambitions, it's not going to put enough of a dent in changing the types of cars we see on the roadway.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff.
So this is such a feel-good story for me, because it feels like every patent-related story is a, patents suck, you know.
Yeah.
This is horrible.
The landscape of journalism around patents is just kind of, it's a mess.
Yeah, so this is your feel-good story for the next 3 years, so just hold on to it.
Soak it up, you guys. This is it.
This is it, yeah. So that's what we have in car news.
Yeah, yeah. Even self-driving cars, which is kind of like a fun innovation. Mm-hmm. That's gotten a little dark spot on it. Someone's been doing some deep thinking about the ethics, he says, of networked cars. His name's David Weinberg.
Oh?
And he says, well, okay, you got your net neutrality, which ideally we all have.
Yeah, net neutrality, the idea that anyone accessing the web will get equal access to the web. Mm-hmm. Like, people won't be able to pay more for a fast lane or more for access to Netflix, but then the people who don't pay more don't get as good access, mm-hmm. et cetera.
So within net neutrality, there's already this metaphor of a slow lane and a fast lane.
Yeah, those are the terms that they use.
And so now we've got self-driving cars, which, you know, so far we have an extremely adorable prototype. That's kind of where it's at.
We covered that two weeks ago.
Extremely adorable.
It looks like a Disneyland car.
I want to drive that car.
Well, you want to sit in the car while it drives you.
I want to be in that car while I get driven around. Beep, beep. it just looks fun.
No steering wheel means no beep, beep horn.
Oh, they've got to have a beep, beep horn.
I want one of those, like, pull down Auga ones. That'd be great.
Well, anyway.
Keeping
so
with the Disneyland
adorable
theme.
Self-driving car.
Yeah.
In its sort of nascent, dewy, really still in a chrysalis kind of, you know.
Yeah.
But still.
Wait, what's this problem that you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm leading up to something here, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that if self-driving cars become what we mostly see on the roadway, then there's the possibility of this net neutrality problem cropping up again. People who pay more for their self-driving car could be paying it to have like a step-aside chip or something so that as it's driving, other cars are convinced to make way for it.
You know, it makes sense that that would exist already for things like ambulances or
police
cars.
Yeah,
you know, like,
that's a good idea.
Yeah, so a police car is barreling down the freeway trying to get to the scene of an accident. You want to get out of the way. Or rather, you want your car to get out of the way.
Right.
So you have to implement that in some way.
Right.
But you're saying
anytime you come up with something juicy, someone will use it for evil.
No.
But what's nice about this, here's the bright spot in the dark cloud.
It's horrible.
It is. But at least someone's thinking about it before the technology has really been designed in a truly networked way. So it's possible to think about these things ahead of time and go, well, do we want that or not? And to think consciously about how we want this new piece of technology to have impact on society.
It's kind of like people sitting around thinking about creating this internet thing and, you know, everyone will be equal on it and, you know, we won't have to deal with this problem later.
It'll be fine. We don't have to think about it. It'll work out.
Well, it is pretty cool. So what's the actual story? Is it a post or is it a...
Yeah, it's a blog post and it's someone just sort of, you know, working on the... philosophizing a bit about the ethics of networked cars. It's a fascinating read and we'll have a link to it at our website. I heard about it, of course, on Boing Boing, but we're going to link to the original article.
So this isn't bad news. It's more of an
exploration.
It's not
bad news. It's a, you guys, let's think about this ahead of time.
Do we want this dystopia?
Exactly.
Mm.
Yeah, let's have a good think about it first.
That's fun.
Which I'm happy. I'm happy anytime anyone sort of puts into the public conversation a little sense of caution and let's think of the greater good.
I love that genre.
That genre.
Blog post? Well, I'm thinking about Ursula K. Le Guin and Kurt Vonnegut, and you know, they kind of think a little bit into the future, and they think,
or Cory Doctorow,
what would happen, Cory Doctorow? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that genre, and it's kind of neat to think to see people doing that, not in a fiction book, but saying like, hey guys, let's actually deal with this problem.
That's a potential
problem.
Read more about it a little bit later at geekspeak.org. You've got some other car news.
I got
By
more
the way,
car news.
This is Geek Speak, not Car Talk. What's your next car story?
Don't drive like my brother. A new car that can lean into curves. So, of course, when you read these kinds of articles about new car features and everything, they're very, very markety and, you know, like they've got all these fancy buzzword term things for all these new technologies.
That's a bane of yours, isn't it?
It kind of irritates me, yeah. But I love the idea and I love the technology. What they have is Mercedes-Benz, and this is not just Mercedes-Benz. A lot of different car manufacturers are doing innovating in these kinds of ways. But they have this thing called active body control suspension, the active body control suspension system. Basically, the suspension system will look at what's ahead of you. Let's say there's a rock that's about to go over your left front tire.
Okay.
And it'll actually ease up on the suspension, the individual suspension for that tire, and let the tire go over it while the body of the car just keeps going straight. Basically, eliminating bumps, actively scanning the road in front of
you. Are you saying like it lifts its skirts a little bit?
Not its skirt, but sure.
Excuse me. It's daintily like skipping over the rock rather than really tucking into it.
It's more like okay, so let's go with the skirt analogy. You're rolling down the street in rollerblades and you're wearing a skirt because, you know, you brought up the skirt.
Because why have good ideas?
And the skirt is the body of the car.
Yeah.
And
it is kind of botched already, this metaphor.
It really is. I don't know about this metaphor, but you see a bump, right?
Yeah.
So what do you do as a human being? I mean, you don't think about it, but you bend your legs a little bit more just as you're going over the bump.
Ah, so that you're anticipating a bumpy ride and making it less for yourself by giving yourself a little more give.
Exactly. So your feet, so that's the idea behind suspension, right?
Okay, yeah.
So you've got suspension on a car and it's just basically a bunch of springs. And the springs cushion the impact. Uh-huh. Well, this is an active suspension system, right? But that's not actually the news, because this has been around for ages. Actually, I think maybe 5 years ago, I saw a video. Uh-huh. It was very markety, but they actually had like this huge thing on the road, and then the suspension actually jumped the car off the ground over this thing, which is so cool.
That is cool.
But the story here is that it will actually lean into curves for you.
So this is building on that same technology to approach the curve conundrum.
Yeah.
Some people do not know, by the way, how to drive in curves. They just don't know how to do it.
Well, you have to slow down.
You have to
before the curve.
Before the curve, then let yourself go through the curve, and then once it straightens out, then you can speed up again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or you can accelerate through at the very end of the curve, but you don't want to be slowing down in the curve.
No.
Driving
tip. It's a recipe for spinning.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, this actually would not let you go faster on curves. That a lot of people would think, okay, well, if your car turns into the curve, then you can go faster. No, that's actually not true, because the wheels are not turning. The wheels are not tilting. What actually happens is, let's say you're making a right turn.
Uh-huh.
The suspension on your right side will actually lower down a little bit, and the suspension on the left side will raise up a little bit, tilting the car into it. And the whole idea is for driver comfort. It's not about speed or necessarily handling.
Okay. It's about
driver comfort.
Not feeling like you're at sea in your own car.
Yeah. So if you go on a roller coaster, the curves are banked for that very reason. Instead of being thrown to the side and getting whiplash, you get pushed down into your seat.
Okay.
So that's the idea there, is that if they can do this just a little bit, it makes their car a little bit more fun to
drive. So they're talking about leaning the wheels so that there is more banking possible?
It's about
just slowing down.
Raising and lowering the different sides of the body of the car in relation to the wheels. So the wheels are still going over the ground and just doing their normal wheelie thing. You know, so.
Doing a wheel.
But yeah, it's kind of neat. I would love a car that does that.
I mean, it sounds like slowly we've been headed towards self-driving cars anyway, because they're making decisions for us.
Yeah, you know, I mean, people talk about self-driving cars and how afraid they are of self-driving cars because the car is making all these decisions for you. But like,
that's been almost going on ever since a computer hit the car, right?
Yes, almost any part of your car these days has a computer in between you and the car itself.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
With a couple exceptions. I'm not a car person. Again, this is not Car Talk, so I can't give you too many details, but it's just they're everywhere, you know?
Well, and I've recently had an experience of traveling very fast through time. I had for years been driving a 1996 Geo Prism, which is, you know, you roll down the windows yourself. It's analog, this car.
Yeah,
it was before the computer thing, right? And so then I just bought a 2010 Toyota.
Wait, how old was your old car?
It was a 96.
Okay, 96.
So I went forward in time to 2010, just now, by getting this new car. And it's telling me when my seatbelt's not on. It's telling me when the lights are on. It's warning me to be a better driver and a better handler of my car than I do by my absent-minded self.
How does it make you feel?
I feel like it's taking care of me. I go, thank you, car, for the reminder.
Do you actually?
Sometimes I do. I go, thank you. Or I'm like, okay, I get it. Thanks for looking out for the team.
Yeah. Does it have a name yet?
No, not yet. It's so new. It's such a generic car now. It doesn't really feel like it's mine until I pee on it in some fashion. I have to mark my territory.
But metaphorically, somehow. I assume.
Metaphorically, yeah. No, I'm not really interested in scent marking my car.
Oh, dear. Okay. How did we get here?
Well, you've done it. You've wasted perfectly good 20 minutes on car topics on GeekSpeak. We're going to be back right after a short break. It's GeekSpeak here on KUSP. Another good show on the station is the 7th Avenue Project. And next time, can science solve every problem? Well, the answer is no. And the proof comes from science itself. Science proves that it cannot prove everything. It's confusing. KUSP's Robert Pauly talks to mathematician and computer scientist Nussin Yanofsky, author of The Outer Limits of Reason, What Science, Mathematics, and Logic Cannot Tell Us. That's on the 7th Avenue Project tomorrow at high noon on KUSP, or whenever you look it up in the talk section at KUSP.org. So yeah, it's Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primsch in the studio with Ben Jaffe. And just a word about our phone answerer, Rick Philman. He's been with us for a long time. We've been very grateful for his presence. And he's taken a look at, there's some juicy thing in San Francisco that might be distracting his time from us here in the new future. But we're not sure. So while we've got him, I want to put him to really good use. Do you have something that you're seeing today in technology news that you'd like to hear us talk about, or what do you want to talk about with us? Give us a call, why don't you? The number is 800-655-5877. Let's put Rick to use. 800-655-5877. Ben, you got a geek bit for us?
I've got two geek bits.
Not just one, but two.
Tell
me the first one. I want the first one.
Okay, so the Soyuz, which is a spaceship, basically, yeah, that we've built. Not we, the United States, but we, humanity, right?
Yeah.
There's a video talking about the re-entry, the undocking, re-entry, and landing of the Soyuz capsule. It is so interesting. It is 20 minutes and 44 seconds long.
Ooh.
I highly recommend anyone who's interested in space watch it. It's really interesting, and it also... they interview some people who have been up to the basically into space and then re-entered via this process, and they talk about what it's like. And it's actually quite a violent process getting back, first of all, from zero G, where you're not feeling any gravity at all.
Yeah.
And then you imagine going back to 1G. That's pretty bad, you know?
1G is more gravity than we usually feel.
1G, no, 1G is the amount of gravity we usually feel.
Oh, okay.
One gravity unit, I guess.
Oh, that makes sense.
I don't actually know what G stands for. I assume it's gravity unit.
Gravity unit. Yeah. We've decided.
But re-entering, I mean, you're slowing down from a very, very, very fast speed.
Yeah.
And so just like in a roller coaster, when you're going in the
bottom
of
the windshield.
You get slammed on the windshield, metaphorically. More into your seat, right?
Yeah.
A little bit safer. But it's really, really interesting to watch.
And so then, it's a video, so you get to see what it looks like and then hear from people what the experience of reentry is like when you're all kinds of things are changing super fast.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of those, like, the Soyuz capsule, blah, 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 blah. Like one of those kinds of documentary things, almost like a BBC kind of feeling thing.
Yeah, and lots of voiceover.
Yeah, in a way it seems interesting, in a way it seems lame, but just watch it, just watch it.
Okay. You were fascinated by it.
The second one, I'm just going to show Bonnie this.
Oh, I get to see it first, you guys. So, what is that? That's like a big old sun flare. What is that?
What do you see?
It's the sun.
Uh-huh.
And there's a ribbon of fire coming out from the surface of the sun and kind of looping back around.
And do you see the Earth to scale?
Oh my gosh. It's a little dot at the bottom. Oh my gosh.
So this is a massive solar flare, right?
Yeah.
Which you see in all kinds of sun related pictures. But they've taken a picture of Earth and they've put it in
scale.
It would be to scale.
So that's not an actual picture of, like,
no.
I'm looking at Earth beyond the sun. That would
no,
be wackadoo.
No. Yeah.
But I'm looking at a solar flare whose peak, what can you, like, fit 100 Earths or something in that thing?
Maybe not 100, but a lot of them. I mean, so when you see pictures of the sun and you see pictures of these huge ribbons of fire, these solar flares coming out, and you're like, whoa, that looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like, that's huge.
That's exactly the opposite of cool. It's very
really
hot.
That is awesome. In the, I would say, the true sense of the word awesome. It is amazing.
Mind-boggling.
Like, so,
and don't get anywhere near it.
That will also be up on geekspeak.org.
You gotta
and
see
you can
that,
actually
you guys.
See it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oof.
Oh, I love your reaction. I was hoping for something like that. Like, whoa.
That's crazy. Well, now that we're hanging out in space, you want to talk about rocky planets?
Sure. I will talk about rocky planets. So, now this is kind of an interesting story. This is very speculative, right?
Mm.
So it's not that we have found this, it's that we may have found maybe this. We may have actually found two giant planets that are orbiting outside of the orbit of Pluto.
Now, I'm just going to embody the spirit of Neil deGrasse Tyson here for just a moment. Are they really planets, or are they just large rocks?
They would be planets, I think. So the things that define a planet, I'm working off of memory here, so don't. But the things that define a planet are, one, that it is big enough to, well, one is that it orbits the sun in a nice and relatively circular
stable
path.
Orbit.
Yeah, stable orbit.
Okay.
Two, that it can clear its orbit. So like if you look at Pluto, you've got Pluto, and then in the same, roughly the same orbit as Pluto, you've got all these other rocks. So Pluto doesn't have big enough gravitational pull to clear its orbit.
Excuse me, I'm here.
Is yeah, like, exactly.
Oh, can I hang out too?
Yeah, exactly. it's like a medium-sized fish in a medium-sized pond full of guppies. But it's not the only fish. That's a horrible, horrible analogy.
Today on Geek Speak, bad mangled metaphors.
I'm sorry, everyone. And there's a third one, too. There's a third thing that makes a planet, rather than a dwarf planet or a plutoid. And Pluto is not a planet. Pluto is a plutoid.
Is it about its gravity helping form the shape of it?
I can't remember. I don't want to say the wrong thing on the air with
all right.
millions of people. No, really.
Well,
listening.
If you know out there, listener.
Then yeah, give us a call.
We need your expertise, apparently. 800-655-5877.
So anyway, back to the story. New planets? What?
That's kind of exciting.
So the
now,
idea.
They're not in our solar system, are they?
Yes.
What?
Yeah. Just outside. Not just outside.
How awkward
outside
for Pluto.
Of Pluto. I know.
Because it could just think, well, it's just because I'm too far away, but now these guys come along. I feel bad for Pluto.
Oh, dear. We haven't been able to actually directly observe these.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of complex how we determine that they might be there. And it has to do with orbital resonance and different planets being in different resonances. And smaller items, like smaller rocks and things flying around the solar system, kind of hanging out in these clumps. And we're like, that's a weird orbit. How did it get into that orbit?
Oh,
it might be from... It would seem to be
maybe
from
something's pulling it along.
Something way out there, yeah. Mm. Just outside of Pluto. Maybe one, maybe two, maybe more. So anyway, I mean that's all I really have to talk about without getting into excruciating detail. But anyway, it's kinda cool. And they're looking at it at the Complutense University of Madrid in Spain. And I don't know, we'll see. But the interesting thing about this is that this was actually predicted back in, I think back just the beginning of this year, that they predicted that maybe due to this and that, there might be something, and then these other observations seem to...
Okay.
So
we're watching science in action, basically.
Yeah, it's snowballing a little bit, but it's not actually something you can throw yet. I don't know.
So there's an observation that causes a question...
Uh-huh.
And then there's some mathematics and theorizing, and then other observations that help support or refute the initial guess.
Yeah.
Science in action.
I like it. I like science.
I like it too. Let's keep following that story.
Yeah.
Okay, because I want to find out. And of course, the question I want to know is, will Neil think they're planets or not?
Will Neil?
That's all I want to know.
My question is, will the bad astronomer Phil Plate think they're planets or not?
Mm.
That guy has an amazing blog, and I highly recommend you follow it. It's at badastronomy.org, and a lot of the stories that I find are from his blog.
So he's got his ear on the ground.
Yeah, he's got his finger on the pulse. He's got his, I don't know.
He's got his skirts on the wheel.
anyway, he's an astronomer and skeptic, which is another thing I love about his blog.
Oh, that's good, too, because he's not like a true believer.
Yeah, true believer. Scientific literacy. So important.
It is. All right. What do we want to talk about now? Let's talk about money.
All right, cool. Well, if we're talking about money, I don't want to talk about dollars. I want to talk about bitcoins.
No, that's fine. I figured.
But okay, so here we go. Sorry, I had to tab over to the story.
Yeah.
United States is auctioning off about 30,000 bitcoins.
Oh, hey, this is a continuation of the story of, like, where'd all those bitcoins go? I guess the feds have them. What are they going to do with them?
Yeah, yeah. So that was the Silk Road, which is a website that it basically existed to distribute drugs, and they took payment in Bitcoin,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Really smart idea, but not so great.
Except for the drugs part, kids.
Yeah, the drugs part. Thank you, yeah. Anyway, but of course, it's not Bitcoin's fault, right?
Yeah,
that's
right.
Kind of like saying, oh, you know, we should eliminate this paper money thing because people use it to buy drugs. Well, you know, okay. Anyway.
We won't take that argument into the gun lobby. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, oh, yeah, we definitely won't.
No. Don't think about that.
So the United States shut down the Silk Road website and seized not all of the Bitcoins, because some of them actually they weren't able to get to, but they got about 30,000 Bitcoins.
So this auction then represents all the Bitcoins that they could get from the Silk Road.
I believe it's all of them. They may have done something with some of them before. I have a faint memory of that. But yeah. Anyway, it's a very good portion of it. So they're selling off 29,656.5130.6529 Bitcoins. Because you can divide Bitcoins
into... That's practically 30,000.
That's almost...
Like, spent the rest on themselves.
That's not that's not practically 30,000. That's a lot of money. It's like 344 more Bitcoins. That's yeah. And each Bitcoin is worth, what is it, 600, something like that?
Oh, that's... Okay. So 30,000 Bitcoins is not $30,000, Bonnie. Keep up.
It looks like they're about 550 right now, as of the recording of this show at 10:33 a.m. on June 14th. So anyway, that's a lot of money. That's,
yeah. You going to get you some?
Not those, no.
No. Well, they're no. Tainted.
They're tainted. They're drug money. Well, I mean, I guess you could make
that
argument.
You have a bit of Bitcoin, don't you?
I have a. It depends on what you define as a bit.
Well, yeah,
don't come after me. I don't have a lot of Bitcoin.
It's a partial Bitcoin, what you have. Or do you have more? You have a unit?
I decide not to discuss my financial situation
fair.
On
you
the
know
air.
What? That's fair.
But no, I don't have a massive amount of Bitcoins, but it was an interest in my of mine, especially because it could be, theoretically, something like it could be the future of money.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Which is amazing. And I love the idea that you own it and not a central institution like a bank or something like that. Mm. Anyway, if you really, really want to buy Bitcoins and for some reason you want to buy them specifically from the federal government,
yeah.
You can take take part of this in this auction where they're auctioning off these 30,000 about. That's like $17 million.
Well, are they, is it like just like a fundraiser for the government or is it fire sale prices? Or?
Yeah, so I can't remember.
Can you get
what
some mad good deals?
I don't think so, no.
No.
Yeah, these are drug Bitcoins. They're worth less. Mm. No, they're worth the same as everything else. So I don't know. I mean, my curiosity is like, what incentive do people have for buying these Bitcoins? And I assume they must be at some...
Marked.
I assume...
That thought just occurred to me.
They must be at some sort of a discount. I mean, like, not necessarily a discount in the sense of, like, here, buy this dollar for 90 cents, but
right.
But more like if you're going to buy a large number of Bitcoins, you're buying a non-trivial fraction of a percentage of all of the Bitcoins that exist.
Yeah.
Therefore, because demand has increased so much, it affects supply.
Ah,
right.
Yeah. So it's going to go, it'll be like a little adjusting to having those Bitcoins back.
Oh, I'm sure there will be. But the other interesting thing about this market is that it's so fast, you know? Like, the Bitcoin market adapts almost instantly to things. And so,
yeah, like, are they still for sale? Or have they all been sold by now?
Oh, I mean, in terms of price fluctuations.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's an amazing... economists are really enjoying looking at the data because it's really kind of a perfect example of this kind of a system. Whereas most examples, you've got all these other variables involved and all that.
Right,
so.
Right. Anyway. Why do you think they're selling them?
Well, we had some theories that
like you could put them to use, like in ferreting out other ills and things like that.
What are the Feds going to do with Bitcoins?
Use them as decoy money when they do undercover.
Are they gonna like
sting operations? And
buy RAM at the computer store where they accept Bitcoins. I mean, like, or buy sushi at the place down the street from my house. Like, there aren't actually a huge number of places that accept Bitcoins. My guess is that federal suppliers probably don't accept Bitcoins because you know, federal, everything tends to move very slowly.
But they could upsell to, you know, capture more criminals.
Yeah, maybe.
But well, they're anyway. Choosing not to do that unless they're marked bills and they're going to watch what those Bitcoins do when they get back into the marketplace.
I highly doubt that.
Can you mark a Bitcoin?
It's not like these Bitcoins have trace amounts of cocaine on them or something like that.
Well, not trace amounts of coin, but just some like a little ID tag. Beep, beep, so they can track where the Bitcoin goes.
You can track any Bitcoin or any fraction of a Bitcoin anywhere.
Oh.
Because it's a public ledger, so...
So maybe that's it then. And
But I wouldn't see the point of it, though.
Of tracking where the Bitcoins go?
Yeah. Like, why would you need to?
Crime. Catching crime.
Well, anyway.
Let's go catch some crime.
Go buy some Bitcoins if you want the government. Yeah, you do have to promise that when you buy these Bitcoins, you're not going to use them for anything affiliated with the Silk Road. Which is like, okay, it's what?
Really? It's a promise? I promise.
It's a promise. You do need to, you do need to.
So then they are keeping track.
Make that statement.
Why would they make you promise unless they can do something about it if you don't? Mm. It's just like, you're not going to do it again, right? Okay.
I don't know. Here maybe it's something to do with that or something. But like, go find the Bitcoins from someone else, you know? Like, it's not like they're the only seller of Bitcoins. Anyway, so it's kind of an interesting story. And presumably they're going to use that however many million dollars to
what about the monies?
Continue to fight crime and ferret out drug lords.
Well, there we go. I get my crime fighting in there somewhere.
Yay. Oh, it's complicated.
Stay in school, kids. All right. So outside of that, what else is happening in the land of technology?
I've got two phone-related stories.
Okay. All right.
So we've got a pro and a con. We've got some good news and bad news. Which one do you want first?
Oh, let's start with the bad news, and we can use the good news as the unicorn chaser.
All right. A new permission system could make Android much less secure. So when you install an application... It says, this application wants to be able to read your SMSs. It wants to be able to have access to your identity, and it wants to, let's say, write to your storage or something like that.
Okay.
And you're like, okay, all right, well, I'm installing blah, blah, blah app, and I can see how it would use those permissions, so I'm okay with this, right?
Okay.
Now, if you try to install a flashlight and it's like, this flashlight app needs to read your identity, track your location, send and you, like, okay,
like,
obviously.
Wait a minute, it's the light that turns on.
There's something weird going on with that one, right? This permission system, which probably most people ignore anyway, which you shouldn't ignore. But
we all do.
Most people do. Yeah. I don't. But,
okay. Well, we all generally usually do. We, Bonnie, do.
It's important.
Yeah.
Because it at the very least, it gives consumers information. Right, about what this app can and cannot do. That way, consumers can make a choice. Wait a second. Final answer. Do I want to install this app, or does it seem weird to me?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's just another, I don't know, failsafe or something.
Yeah. Information is never bad.
Well, Android, they've made a change to the Google Play Store, and so now it groups these app permissions into collections of related permissions. So what the heck does that mean? Well, it means that if, let's say this app wants to read your SMSs, okay?
Wait, let's go over it just for the kids. SMS means?
Text message.
Okay.
It wants to be able to read your text messages.
What? Okay. Wait a minute. Now I'm offended.
So with the old system, it says, I want to be able to read your text messages. You say, okay, that's fine. You can read my text messages. I'm going to install the app. If the app then wants to ever send a text message, they need to release an update that says, hey, Ben Jaffe, can I send text messages too? And I have to explicitly say,
yes,
I'm now okay. I'm okay with this.
It's opt-in.
Or no, why would you ever need to send a text message? Yeah. That's not okay with me.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. The new way, it says, this app needs SMS permissions.
Oh, that's pretty general. You don't know if they're talking about reading or writing.
Uh-huh. And so I say SMS permissions, okay, sure, yeah, they can see my text messages. I install
it. It's interpretable.
I install it, and then the app can release an update where they can now write as well, right? Like send SMSs, send text messages.
But they don't have to ask you because it still falls under the general guideline of SMS permissions.
Exactly. So basically, they're taking the granularity of these permissions.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of grouping them into these big groups. And there are some weird groups, too. I mean, like, I'm trying to remember.
Like Netflix movie categories? Weird?
No, there's you know what, I can't find it, but there are some weird permissions that I don't really see why they should be grouped together, but they are, and so I don't know.
Seems nefarious already. Kind of like, well, it's your
just,
angle.
It's just weird, you know. It's just strange, and I don't like this change. You know,
yeah.
Basically, less information for the user. I don't know, bad.
Yeah, bad. Less access to information, right?
Yeah, I do have a unicorn chaser, but maybe we should talk about that after a break.
I just want to chew on this for one more minute.
Chew on it more.
Okay. So it's about the companies having more flexibility in their updates and not having to ask permission.
Yes.
Right? Is that why you think they're doing that?
Well, I think it's probably like, so for example, Apple has a tendency to make things super, super simple.
Yeah.
To my dismay, because now I have fewer options. I'm okay. Kind of a geek. I like customizing things. I like changing settings, but most users don't. And so the reason people like Apple and find it so easy to use is because there are fewer options.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the paralysis of choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
My guess, I don't know for certain, but my guess is that this is an attempt to move more towards that.
Okay.
But at the expense of security or potentially
of total
privacy.
Flexibility. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
So
it's that eternal struggle between all more information than you require and ease of use.
Yeah. And as an app developer, I understand the benefit of not having to think, okay, I just started making an app. What could I possibly ever want to do with this in the future? I should ask for those permissions. Like, that's also a bad model.
That's hard, yeah.
Right? And also, if I forget something, then I have to bug my users again, and then the users might not update.
Right, okay.
So yeah, it's a complicated issue, but I don't know. I think this change is a overall negative.
Has a film of meh.
A film of meh. That's a very good way of putting it.
Good. With as few vowel sounds as possible. All right. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primsch, and with me in the air room is Ben Jaffe. You are invited to join the conversation. Also, Rick Filmon is here to take your calls and get you on the air. And the phone number is 800-655-5877. All right, so you left us with a little film of meh, but you've got some good news to kind of clear that up.
You know, I've got another story about which we'll talk about in a second. Oh. But yeah. But so this is strange. Normally, I have negative things to say about Apple, actually,
uh-huh.
and not maybe more okay things to good things to say about Google. That was a bad thing about Google, believe it or not. In the same news week cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a good thing to say about Apple. iOS 8, the new version of iOS,
which is
coming out.
Yeah.
The headline is iOS 8 strikes an unexpected blow against location tracking. Now,
what?
Why unexpected?
Location tracking. That's you'd think that's what people are wanting more and more of.
Yeah,
not people. Excuse me. Companies.
Companies. No, not people. No. They didn't talk about this when they talked about iOS 8 on stage at WWDC and all that
it
stuff.
It wasn't a braggable feature.
No, but it's kind of cool. So basically what it does is when you're trying to connect to a network, right? You're basically reaching out and saying like, "Hey, are you an open network?" No, mm-hmm. that, you know, and kind of talking with all these different networks.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's sent along is something called your MAC address. Your MAC address is a unique, unchanging address. It's unique to your machine. It's mm-hmm. specifically, it's unique to your network adapter.
Yeah, it's how a network knows that that which machine it's inviting in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so now, when iOS 8 devices, so your new iPhone later on, it hasn't been released yet,
mm-hmm.
when they look for a connection, instead of saying, "Hey, I want a connection, here's my MAC address. I want a connection, here's my MAC address." It actually, they randomize the MAC addresses until they connect to a network, effectively. So basically, all the networks that you're reaching out to that you're not actually connecting to, fully connecting to,
uh-huh.
they don't have your MAC address anymore. So they can't necessarily track you.
Oh, okay. So it's like one-time use kind of stuff. It's kind of like the keys that Lyle talks about for passwords.
Kind of. But it just means that all of these different services that you're, all of these different routers that you're trying to connect to, they don't necessarily know who you are until you decide to actually connect to them.
Okay.
So when your computer reaches out and says, like, hey, what Wi-Fi people, what Wi-Fi access points are nearby?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Wi-Fi access points respond.
Yeah.
That MAC address that your computer is broadcasting on iOS 8, it's not actually your MAC address. It's a randomized MAC address.
Okay, so now I'm thinking about that movie with all the rotoscoping that was based on a Philip K. Dick novel where Keanu Reeves was wearing kind of like a randomizing suit, and he just looked like a sort of like a bunch of people. And it was indistinct who he actually was when he was undercover working as a cop.
Huh.
What was the name of that movie?
I have no idea.
I've got such mom brain this weekend.
Oh,
I can't remember
no.
the name of anything.
Mom brain.
But randomizing like that, you don't really know who Keanu Reeves is because all these different faces and features are flat. Like what you see is kind of like could be anybody.
So it'd be like if Keanu Reeves was everybody, nobody, whatever random person until he decided that he was going to talk to somebody.
Oh, I took
then
off
all
my
of a
suit.
Sudden,
now you know who I am.
Bam.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, Keanu. What's up?
Yeah.
Yeah, or whatever his character name
hey,
was.
Hey, you guys, it's me. Keanu.
Hey, you guys.
All right. Well, my pleas for some phone calls have come through. We have Walt from Santa Cruz who's got something that he can't get rid of. I want to know more about that. Oh, no, first I have to select the call, apparently. Here we go. Walt, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. How are you doing?
Boy, that sounds like an STD I've got, but it's not...
You've got something that you can't get rid of. All right, so it's not an STD. So that good.
That's good news. It's an Android phone, okay? And I've got all of these applications that Google automatically loads. I've got 50 of them, and I can't get rid of them. When you load applications yourself, and then they guess they call them machine apps or something like that. I've got game crap that, you know, all kinds of things, and there's no option to get rid of it that I know of. How can I get rid of it?
So it is like an STD.
For your phone.
For your phone.
Well, this is actually kind of a complex issue and one that I have also dealt with accordingly because it ticks me off too. It really irritates me.
At least you're not alone, Walt.
I should be able to control the things that I want on my phone. So, first of all, it's not necessarily only Google. Right. Google is in charge of Android, of making Android, and they basically make it available to all of these different phone manufacturers, and the phone manufacturers tend to tweak it in all sorts of different ways, and they put their own stuff on it. And so, like, for example, I have a Samsung Galaxy S3, and when I got the phone, it had all kinds of crazy Samsung stuff on it, right? Mm-hmm. And it was always asking me, oh, do you want to use Samsung's this and Samsung's that? And I kept saying no, and eventually it stopped bothering me. So there are, I'm trying to remember. There's a way of disabling the, okay, I think I remember, yes. So I think what you have to do is you have to go into the place where you normally uninstall apps from. You go into the preferences, into the place where it lists all of your apps. I can't remember the name of the menu item. And then you can go in there and for the apps that you install, it'll say uninstall and you can remove it, right? But for the apps that are on your phone that you didn't install, that button is grayed out. Instead, you can remove all of the updates that you have subsequently applied. And then after you do that, you should have, I think, a disable button. And you can try that. It might work. It might not work. I'll find a link to some website or forum that's talking about that process. I'll put it up on geekspeak.org. Another possibility, which is much, much more complicated, but maybe more fulfilling if you're very geeky like me, is you can install a different ROM, basically a different version of the Android operating system compiled by somebody else, not by Samsung. And the most popular one is called CyanogenMod. And that's kind of like the toxic chemical Cyanogen and then mod as in modification. And that's a really fantastic operating system. I highly recommend it, but only for people who are willing to go through the potentially very easy, but potentially very difficult process of getting it on your phone. If you want to try that, you can Google around for your phone and CyanogenMod and find people talking about whether they've had success or whether they weren't able to do it, what the steps were and everything, and make sure that you have a backup of all of your photos and data and all of that stuff before trying it. So anyway, yeah, those are the two options that I'm aware of being a longtime Android user.
Well, let's check in with Walt. Walt, did that make sense? Did we lose Walt?
Oh, maybe I bored him.
Oh, poor guy fell asleep. Maybe he's busily working on exactly that just now. I hope that works out for Walt.
Yeah. So, Walt, if you are still listening, pop up over to geekspeak.org, and I'll go ahead and find a link and put it up there for you.
Okay. So, for anyone else who's suffering that same heartache, that information will be up there for you also. Lovely. All right. So, that was the juicy phone thing to counteract the bum-out phone thing.
Yeah. That was that.
What's the other squeaky?
Oh, yeah. That was
I mentioned you can clean things up by going, and so, that reminded you of something.
Yeah, we were talking about this before the show, and Bonnie and I were, and it's a website that you can go to, which claims to clean your screen so that way it's sharper and crisper and the colors are more vibrant and everything. Mm-hmm. So what happens is, you go to this webpage, and it sits there for a while. It full screens, you full screen it. It sits there for a while, and it says calibrating. And a little progress bar goes up, and it maybe takes about a minute, maybe 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Once it's done calibrating, it just wipes away all of this grime and dust and whateverness on your screen. And all of a sudden, your screen looks so much more vibrant and better and more beautiful. And like,
that doesn't make any sense.
It's a webpage, right?
Yeah.
How does that work? That doesn't make any sense. So when I saw this, I figured out how they do it, actually. What they do is when they're calibrating, I put that in air quotes, right?
Okay.
When they're calibrating, what they're doing is they're taking the image on your screen and they're very slowly and subtly making it less saturated colors.
Oh, it's an illusion.
Less contrast. Yeah, okay. More kind of gray and fuzzy. So over the course of 2 minutes, they very subtly fade your screen to look more drab.
Uh-huh.
And then once it looks more drab, then they have a place to go and they can kind of wipe away, quote unquote, all of the grime and drabness and everything and restore it to how it looks before. But the amazing thing is, I think that when people find this website, find this tool and they use it, they really believe it works. And they're like, wow, my screen looks so much better than before. I'm so happy.
Yeah.
So in that way, is it evil? Is it bad to mislead?
Or was it entertaining? The whole thing sounds a little bit like a magic trick to me.
Yeah, it kind of seems like that. It's just playing on the fact that we can't perceive really slow changes to contrast and to saturation. There was another version of this. This is my favorite version.
Hmm.
It's the exact same thing, except instead of just wiping away all the grime.
Yeah, and what do you mean by wiping away?
I just mean like this circle thing comes on your screen and just moves around the screen. And behind it, it's kind of like those cleaning commercials. You know, you've got the cloth and it swoops across, and all of a sudden, everything's
where
really
the cloth
shiny.
Was, then it's shiny.
Mm-hmm.
So where the circle was, then it shines out. Okay.
Well, someone made a parody version of this where a dog comes up and licks your screen. Like you see its tongue, kind of like a tongue on a window. And then at the end, it looks all nice and sparkly and everything. Yeah. Like, good job, dog.
The cleanup dog.
I love that. That was my favorite version.
I mean, it is fun that people take the time to do something that strikes me as just like a toy, like a computer toy,
oh, yeah,
like
an
internet bauble.
Yeah, I saw that and I'm like, huh? And you know,
how
like
you do it?
People tell you not to click on suspicious or weird looking links.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't have clicked on it because like I knew that wasn't possible, but
yeah.
I did it anyway.
You did it anyway.
Oh, man. But it did give me a laugh. So
oh, all right.
Maybe I'll look for that. And if I can find it,
it'd be
if
fun
it's
to see.
Still up, yeah, then yeah. I'll.
Okay.
I'll put it up on geekspeak.org.
Do you have another quick one to take us out? We're almost at the end of the
show.
I've
got a quick one, yes, which is the U.S. government just okayed sharper satellite images. So up until now, the government prohibited satellite operators from selling images to foreign or commercial organizations where you could see anything that's smaller than 50 centimeters. Basically,
for some sort of governmental
security
reasons.
Blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
Boop-a-doop-a-doo.
Yeah.
So Now satellite operators are allowed to.
What do you think caused the shift?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. But I don't know if this is ironic or Alanis Morissette ironic, but this announcement came in the same week that Google said it would buy satellite imaging startup Skybox Imaging for $500 million.
Interesting.
But I don't think they were related, because Skybox touts that it can capture images at, quote, sub-meter resolution, not 50 centimeter.
Yeah, how many 50 centimeters are, I guess that'd be half a meter.
People are speculating maybe Skybox doesn't actually have high enough resolution that they're affected by this at all. But It's just kind of interesting, you know, like seeing this relaxing of these rules that were put into place because of national security. So That means that over time, we're going to see even better, sharper satellite images.
It is advantageous for Google to have an ability to see even sharper now that they have this system, the Skybot system.
If
because now
Skybot
that Google
system,
Earth thing is going to be cray cray.
Cray cray. That's the word for it.
That is the word for it. Well, there it is, Geek Speak for today, for the 14th of June, 2014. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And we're a Geek Speak, a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you like. Just tell them it came from the geeks. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP, Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit GeekSpeak.org.